Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Patrick D. McCoy, the African American voice in classical music, and I want to welcome you to this very special show today. First of all, I want to thank you all so much for tuning in with my interview last week with internationally acclaimed concert organist Diane Bish. That interview with Diane Bish so far is my top number one interview out of all of the interviews that I've done on Blog Talk Radio, so I certainly want to thank you for that. Now, let's talk about today's show. Today is a very special show because we're kind of pushing the envelope just a little bit. We're actually going to go into the area of jazz. Named the Kennedy Center's Artistic Advisor for Jazz on November 29, 2011, jazz pianist Jason Moran has proven more than his brilliance as a performer since his formidable emergence on the music scene in the late 90s. The Blue Note Records recording artist has established himself as a risk-taker and innovator of new directions for jazz as a whole in almost every category that matters: improvisation, composition, group concept, repertoire, technique, and experimentation. Moran and his group, The Bandwagon, with bassist Taurus Metin and drummer Nasheed Waits, have challenged the status quo and earned their reputation as the future of jazz. Without further ado, I want to welcome to the show today Jason Moran. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, man, thank you so much. It's quite an honor to have you on today. Now, let's just get right to it. Talk to me about your recent appointment at the Kennedy Center as the Artistic Advisor for Jazz. First of all, congratulations.
Right. Thank you. It's quite amazing. In all of my years as a performer, I never thought I would be put in a position where I could curate performances for the nation's performing arts institution in Washington, D.C. So this is quite an honor, and it's also an honor to follow in the footsteps of my predecessor and also a mentor and pianist and himself, Dr. Billy Taylor, who is kind of also responsible for representing jazz and kind of talking to America about jazz, whether it was on CBS Sunday Morning or his own creation, this organization called Jazzmobile, which puts jazz in the communities throughout New York. So he's quite a figure to follow, and so there's a lot of territory to tread.
Now, Billy Taylor was a name that I heard all throughout my undergraduate study at Virginia State University, because Billy Taylor is one of our most famous alumni. So
that was a
special name. Now, that's a big title, advisor for jazz at the Kennedy Center. How much time are you required to actually be at the center as opposed to all of your performance engagements?
Well, what we've tried to do is figure out a schedule where I would at least be at the center once a month, whether it's for meetings or for performances, and also to see the other performances. I mean, the Kennedy Center on one level has a performance every day, a free performance every day at 6 o'clock, 365 days a year. I mean, just to kind of to experience what the Kennedy Center has to offer, I have to be down there more. So that's what my goal is. I mean, and I'm also throughout this season, which starts in October, I'll be appearing, I think, 4 or 5 times, and also be doing some special education things for students. And so there's a lot going on. And so I'll be there. You know, it's like I'm still a resident of New York, but I'll be in D.C. quite a bit.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Make sure that we spread the word about all those performances. Now,
right.
You were talking about education, and it always makes me really start talking about the youth. When did you get the music bug? When did you catch the music bug? Talk to me about that.
Well, my parents, I grew up in Houston, Texas, and they were middle-class African-Americans. And what they did is they would always take us to see, you know, whether it was Alvin Ailey was coming to town, okay, we'll see that. Or there was a special exhibition at a museum of somebody we would go see that. Painter John Biggers was kind of living in Texas at the time. Or if, like, Andre Watts was playing with an orchestra, we would always go see Andre Watts play. And so they kind of kept that arts bug within us as children, like kind of they kept it in our diet just as much as golf or basketball or tennis or whatever, any sport. They would also keep the arts in mind for us. And they weren't artists, but they were appreciators of the forms. And at age six, they put me in piano classes. Both of my brothers. I'm the middle son of three boys, and you know, keeping African American boys out of trouble is a difficult task. And
right.
My parents decided through music and through a lot of activities that they would kind of keep us off of the streets in Houston and kind of into these programs or into these activities. And to a degree, well, yeah, it worked totally. I mean, we've all made it out of our statistic stage. But so that's when I caught the bug. I was age six, and through age six to age 13, I was doing Suzuki piano. And I thought, you know, this is interesting, and I kind of did it as a chore, and I kind of recognized that I was able to do it easily enough, but I never really wanted to put any energy into it. But at age 13, I heard Thelonious Monk, one of the greatest pianists. Well, for me, he's the greatest pianist in the world. And I heard him playing a solo rendition of a piece of his called Round Midnight. And from that point on, it was clear that that was who I wanted to be. I wanted to be like him. I emulated him. I bought all of the records I could with my chore money. And from that point on, I was bit by the bug of jazz and by the bug of piano.
Wow, you hit two points that I want to kind of dig into. First of all, you talked about Monk, so that takes me right to my next point. Tell us a little bit about the commission that you received with your project In My Mind, Monk at Town Hall in 1959.
Well, that was a commission from four performing arts organizations in America, which were Duke University, which was kind of the major proponent of it, San Francisco Jazz Festival, Chicago Symphony Center, and the Washington Performing Arts Society. And what they did was they threw into a pool to help me create this work, which was looked at a recording of Thelonious Monk's called Thelonious Monk at Town Hall. It was recorded in 1959. And this was also Monk's first recording with a larger ensemble than a quartet. It had 10 people on it. And he was also, this was his first return to New York as a performer after having his cabaret card taken away from him. Back in those days, he had to have this card to play anywhere in the city. So he was returning to the city, so it was a big ordeal. And so my commission was to look at what I found through the Jazz Loft archives. They found these tapes of Thelonious Monk actually rehearsing all of this music. Now, what you have to think about how amazing this is as a find is because there are no recordings of Mozart rehearsing his music. You know, there are no recordings of Beethoven rehearsing or creating or in the process. But here's literally tapes and hours of tape of Thelonious Monk in his process of creating the music for this concert, you know, with the arranger. And so what I aim to do is to explode this concert rather than to just look at the repertoire, but to really dive deep inside it. So at one level, we look at how Thelonious Monk created this music through this process of playing these audio tapes during the performance. But also, I go way back into his great-grandparents' history as slaves in North Carolina, which is where they got the last name Monk, as everyone knows it. Your slave name becomes the name that then follows you through history. So Thelonious Monk, as cool as it sounds, is also still a vestige of America's slavery. And so we do all this, we explode the music, and while the music is playing, I work with a video artist named David Dempywolf, and we created, you know, a lot of video that just kind of accompanies each piece. So you really kind of get inside what the piece represents for me personally, since Thelonious Monk is my hero, but also what it meant for Thelonious as a process of an evolving musician.
Well, I hope to see that because multimedia presentations that involve music are always so engaging, and it's always an opportunity to bring people in who might not just sit down and listen to a conventional jazz or classical concert with the media. So that,
right.
that is powerful,
right.
And I hope to get the chance to see that myself. Now, let's go back a little bit further in your previous statement. You had mentioned Andre Watts. I'm sure there are a lot of people listening who are trying to pursue either jazz or classical, but just talk to us about how you use the classical training to basically accent what you do as a jazz musician.
Well, you know, training is training. You know, time on the instrument is time on the instrument. You can never get around having to spend time studying the craft of just what it is technique-wise. And, you know, my first piano teacher, her name was Yelena Kernets. She was a recent, you know, immigrant from Russia, and she was responsible for really ingraining this kind of technique that I still use today, which is, you know, your curved fingers and making sure they aren't flat and knowing how to pull tone out of the instrument. And these things are the things that that stay with me the longest. So every time I return to Houston to play a concert, she's in the audience and I can still see her, you know, examining my technique. So, you know, that's how it starts, you know. But also the bigger thing that I learned maybe when I got to Manhattan School of Music was how to listen and how to learn repertoire. So when I got to up to New York was finally when I was able to hear Debussy and Ravel and Chopin and Beethoven, like, and hear them not as a young kid, but kind of as a young adult. And those songs kind of take on different meaning. Bach takes on different meaning as an older musician. And so then how to dive into repertoire. And so I still use that way of diving into repertoire today. I mean, the most obvious point for me as a reference is my wife, Alicia Hall Moran, who I met at Manhattan School of Music. She has been a big proponent of having me, like, really look at Lieder. You know, like, so earlier in one of my solo piano CDs, I recorded a piece from Schumann's Song Cycle, Auf einer Burg. And, you know, like, so she had me, like, think about these pieces as just as important as Thelonious Monk. So I have to really consider Schumann. And so she's been paving the way for me in that way.
That's amazing. And also, congratulations to your wife, who's, as I'm not mistaken, has she been on Broadway in Porgy and Bess?
Yes, currently. She's on Broadway in Porgy and Bess and is Audrey McDonald's understudy and performs every Wednesday night as Bess. She's quite a... my wife is quite, you know, she's as crazy as I am artistically.
Look, you see how I got that child in there?
Right. I appreciate that.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back. I see that you have a wonderful performance coming up after this weekend on July 28th with mm-hmm. Michelle and Degger Cello. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, yes, I can. I mean, Michelle is a fantastic bassist and composer and vocalist, and I mean, I've long been a fan of her since I was in high school, and I was approached by the organization Harlem Stage, and they present many concerts up in Harlem, and they have for 30 years, and they commissioned me to make a piece of about Fats Waller. So in the same way that I addressed Thelonious Monk, now I'm addressing Fats Waller. But I'm addressing Fats Waller as a Harlem native, as a pianist and as a composer, and also as a musician that likes to get the party started. You know, he likes to have people dancing. So we created the Fats Waller Dance Party as a way to engage an audience that wants to dance. You know, mm-hmm. I find it therapeutic to have to move your body to music. And not only do I, but so do cultures all around the world. You know, just the activity of moving while listening is it can heal a lot of pain. So we created this Fats Waller party that is it's free to the public on Saturday, and it's uptown in Harlem, and it's a wonderful event, you know, filled with a lot of songs that we've reorganized to fit, you know, dancing standards for today. So it sounds more like R&B and hip hop than it does like swing music from 1930. So, and I, just as a pianist, I wanted to finally play for an audience that was ready to dance. I mean, for all my years as a performer, I'd never played for a dancing audience. And so this is my great project that finally has me do it. And, you know, it's like comedy. When you go to see a comedy show, you're supposed to laugh at some point. So if you're going to go see the Fats Waller Dance Party, you're supposed to dance at some point. So this is the goal.
All right, now, and I was reading when I was doing my little research, I had to make sure I was polished, and I was talking to such an esteemed musician. I saw that you all did 4 performances in 2011 that were sold out.
Right. Yeah, that was a big success. That was part of the Harlem Jazz Festival. Yeah, it was amazing to do and exhausting. I mean, to play for people who dance, not to play for people who sit down. You know, you're DJs, yeah.
Well, want to announce to the listeners, especially if you're in the New York area, I would love for you to go check out the Fat Swallow Dance Party, which is July 28th at 4 p.m. at Amsterdam Avenue at 134th Street at Annunciation mm-hmm. Park. And again, it is being produced by Harlem Stage, so we definitely want to make sure that we're out and about supporting this wonderful thing. As we wind down the interview, a lot of times I like to talk about style because, again, there's usually people who are listening and they might be performers. Now, when sometimes when people talk about jazz music, there's a misconception that there's no structure or, you know, you just do everything where it happens. Talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on improvisation. Is it ever too much?
Well, I mean, you know, jazz, see, we have to look at the culture of jazz. Jazz is, and blues and gospel music, these are songs, these are forms of music that are built on self-expression. Mm-hmm. And these are songs that were born out of a time when African Americans didn't have as much self-expression as they needed and wanted. So through these songs, you were almost speaking in code to tell your story. I mean, many older jazz musicians that I play with, as I'm playing, they'll yell out to me, tell your story, you know, so... Mm-hmm. Say your song. So how do you do this? So what improvisation becomes is this kind of code in which you tell your life through various songs and through various sounds. So improvisation is not jazz unless it has improvisation in it. And each night you could perform in a different way. But we always, you know, are functioning off of some kind of blueprint about what the music is, whether it's a blueprint that is actually a song form, AABA, or whether the blueprint is we have 60 minutes to play, you know, so how much, what will we do in 60 minutes? I mean, all of these are structures, and over time, just as we learn, if I listen to a sonata form and have to learn it in classical and finally hear where the form exists, it sometimes is hidden until we listen to the music more and more and more. And how each soloist and how each musician in the band is also in a conversation and a dialogue with each other. It's one of the great forms, which is why it's all around the world, because people want to be a part of telling their story, so the music becomes a journal entry.
That was wonderfully put. Just as we about to wind down, I certainly want to thank you for sharing this time with us. It's just been a treat to have you on. I want everybody to know that you can continue to follow Jason on his website at www.jasonmoran.com, and certainly he's at the Kennedy Center, so you can certainly go to the Kennedy Center website and check out all the appearances that he will make there. And just in closing, if you had a takeaway for a young aspiring jazz musician who was on this road as jazz as a career, what would you maybe suggest?
One is find the oldest musician that you can find and study with them. That's one. And then two is listen. And then three is spend time in the shed, as they say. You have to be practicing. You have to be on that instrument. If you love it, it won't even feel like practicing. It'll just be all learning. And through that becomes the vast landscape of explorative music.
Again, we've been speaking with Jason Moran, Artistic Advisor for Jazz at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Jason, thank you so much for being on today.
My pleasure, Patrick. Thank you.
Again, listeners, that was Jason Moran, Artistic Advisor for Jazz at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. What a wonderful opportunity it was to speak with them. Again, I would like for you all to check out Jason at the Fat Swallow Dance Party this weekend, July 28th, 4 o'clock p.m. at Annunciation Park in New York City. This is being presented by Harlem Stage, and it's going to also feature with him Michelle Indegurcello, who is such a wonderful musician, as Jason Moran said. Again, I want to thank you all for joining me for this installment of the African American Voice in Classical Music. I am Patrick D. McCoy, the African American Voice in Classical Music, and I thank you for your support. You may follow me on Twitter at Patrick D. McCoy. You may also like my Facebook page, which is Patrick D. McCoy, the African American Voice in Classical Music. Again, I am Patrick D. McCoy, the African American Voice in Classical Music, and I do want to wish you all a wonderful day.